Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, it's getting closer and closer. The election is nearly upon us. And a lot going on out there all across the United States, all around the world. Still, as far as I know, a GI being held kidnapped in Iraq. Economic mess in the United States. The headline, I'm in broadcasting, Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from San Francisco today. Screaming headline at the top of San Francisco Chronicle, Bay Area foreclosures on the rise, adjustable loans a growing threat. Is the Republicans bringing us another economic disaster? Who knows? But it's the first hour of our Friday program, and as always, in our first hour, it's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Congressman Bernie Sanders, the only member of the House of Representatives who is neither a Democrat nor a Republican, an independent, and therefore, well, not just therefore there, but because of his positions on so many issues, I think of Bernie as America's congressman, not just Vermont's, although he does a marvelous job representing his state of Vermont. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466, if you want to drop into our live chat room, TomHartman.com. Hey, Bernie.
How are you, Tom?
I'm great. How are you this morning?
Very well, thanks.
News for you, by the way. The quake in San Francisco, KQKE, has been carrying this program. They have been time delaying it. In fact, they are right now. People will hear this program at 6 p.m., from 6 to 9 p.m. in the evening in San Francisco. And starting a week from Monday, they will be carrying our program live. So we'll be getting more callers from San Francisco because it'll be live in San Francisco. So it's great news, and thanks to the quake for that.
Well, that's great.
So the national election seems to be going crazy here. I mean, everybody's pouring money in. The Harold Ford, these racist attacks against him, just bizarre stuff out here.
Well, what is interesting, I think, from a national perspective, is that it appears, and we don't want to be premature and we don't want to get into too much speculation, but it does appear that the American people are finally catching up with what Republican right-wing extremism is about. According to all of these pundits, for whatever it may be worth, the odds are that the Democrats will, in fact, recapture the House of Representatives, and the Senate is up in the air. There are about five races which are within the margin of error, and if they go for the Democrats, they can capture the Senate. If they don't, the Republicans will have control of the Senate. But it does seem that from one end of this country to the other, including the South, including among some of the most conservative elements of American society, evangelical Christians, for example, there seems to be an understanding that right-wing extremism is not working for ordinary people, that in fact we end up having today not only the most incompetent administration and the most reactionary administration in modern American history, but with the Republican leadership in the House and the Senate, the most corrupt political leadership in our lifetime. So the good news is there appears to be a wave sweeping the country, which may make profound political changes in Washington. But the reality is that we still have a week and a half to go, and people are going to have to work very, very hard. Because while the Republican Party is not terribly interested or good in public policy, that's not their thing, they are very, very good in politics. And historically, they have been much more successful than those of us in the opposition in dragging out every living person who can possibly vote. So the message for today is that if you're serious about the need to change the direction in America, if you're sick and tired of Bush, Cheney, and their agenda, we've got a week and a half to go to make sure that everybody we know gets out to vote.
Yeah, and whether that means going door to door, whether that means going to MoveOn.org and signing up for their national be a phone bank person, you know, from the comfort of your own living room for a couple of hours, however you want to do it. I'm assuming that there may be other ways that you know of, Bernie.
Well, there are many ways, but I think, you know, frankly, grassroots activities are the most effective. I mean, just making sure that everybody you know is registered to vote, making sure that people get out on Election Day, make sure that if they can't get out on Election Day, they can vote in many states through absentee ballots. But just in any way you can, get people out there to cast their votes. You know, what's also happening, Tom, when you get to the last few weeks of a campaign, you really get to see what candidates and parties are all about. And when push comes to shove, after all is said and done, you see where the Republican Party has got to go, where they really come from. And that is not about serious ideas, about serious issues. It's not about health care. It's not about education. It's not about the war in Iraq. It's not about the environment. You look at what's going on in Tennessee, and they're back to their good old-fashioned racism against Harold Ford. In Ohio, it's homophobia. They're trying to suggest that the gubernatorial candidate there is gay. They're running around the country now on this homophobic kick out of the decision from the Supreme Court in New Jersey. These guys are politically and ideologically bankrupt. They have nothing to say seriously about the decline of the middle class in America, the increase in poverty, the growing gap between the rich and the poor. Zero. Nothing to say. They have nothing to say about 7 million more Americans losing their health insurance. Nothing to say at all. They don't believe that all Americans should have health care as a right of citizenship. They have virtually nothing to say about global warming when they're so tied to the fossil fuel companies and the oil companies, and they give these guys huge tax breaks. They're the last people on the planet to understand, it seems, that we've got to break our dependence on fossil fuel and move to energy efficiency and sustainable energy. So I think when push comes to shove, and you see it in the last week, 10 days of a campaign, they resort back to the same old stuff, which is homophobia, which is racism, which is all kinds of stuff which deflects attention away from the real issues facing the middle class and working families. And the reason for that is they really don't have much to say on the important issues.
Well, in a way, they do. They just don't want to say it. I mean, you know, what we've seen is you look at the Dow, for example, from 1900 to today, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average, you know, was in the hundreds, and it slowly crept up to the thousand, you know, to around 1,000 around 1980. Reagan comes into office, and suddenly there's this enormous shift in wealth from people earning income by working wages to people earning income by investing. And the investor class explodes and the Dow explodes, but the average working person is screwed. And so we, you know, the Dow Jones, it's like every time a company lays off another 10,000 people, their stock goes up.
Did you see this story today about Ford Motor Company now?
Yeah.
Basically shutting down plant after plant in the United States as they move to China.
Yeah.
And that will be the entire automobile industry within the next 10 or 15 years. But your point is well taken. And these are the issues that we must demand serious discussion about. Very simple. Technology is exploding. Worker productivity is way up. Why is the middle class shrinking? Why is that? Why is poverty increasing? Well, you know, honest people may have differences of opinion as to the causation. But this is exactly the kind of issue that needs to be discussed, not whether Harold Ford of Tennessee attended a party and dates, you know, women. And we need to force discussion on those issues. We need to ask the questions of why, in fact, those issues are not being discussed. Is it an important issue that 13,000 of the wealthiest families in America earn more income than the bottom 20 million? Well, some people may say, no, it's not important. It doesn't matter. I think it does matter. I think there's a moral component. There's an economic, political component to the increasingly unequal distribution of wealth and income in America. Let's put that out on the table. Why isn't it not being? Why is this issue not being discussed in the major media? Is there a reason? Well, maybe it has something to do with the fact that corporate America owns, to a very significant degree, the media in America, radio, television, newspapers. Is that a problem? Yeah, I think it is. What are we going to do about it? I don't know. Let's throw that out on the table. My point here is what we need to force is serious discussion about serious issues as to why the gap between the rich and the poor is growing wider, why we are the only country in the industrialized world without a national health care program, why we are not doing what we should be doing to protect our environment, why we have the highest rate of childhood poverty of any industrialized nation, the whole issue of foreign policy, whether preemptive war and arrogance really is going to help defeat terrorism, really is going to make the world and the United States a safer place. Those are some of the issues that we have to force discussion on.
Yeah, and these guys just don't want to talk about it. Paul Craig Roberts, for example, the Assistant Secretary of Treasury under the Reagan administration and editor at the Wall Street Journal, recently wrote an article in which he said he's talking about the first 5 years of the Bush administration. He says in 5 years, communications equipment lost 42% of its workforce. Semiconductors and electronic components lost 37% of its workforce. This is in the United States, of course. The workforce in computers and electronic products declined 30%. Electrical equipment and appliances lost 25% of their employees. Motor vehicles, 12%. Furniture, 17%. Apparel manufacturers and textile mills, 43% loss of workforce. Paper lost one-fifth of its workforce. Plastics, rubber products, 15%. I mean, how can they call this a good economy?
Well, they call it a good economy because the rich are, in fact, doing very, very well. And that's what they look at. That's what a good economy is. If millionaires make more money and get tax breaks, it's a good economy. But what Roberts is saying is exactly right. And the question there is how you remain a major economic force if our productive capabilities are being diminished significantly every single day.
Yeah, and we need some just fundamental, first of all, a reasonable discussion about real issues, and
then
fundamental structural change.
Right.
I mean, 26 years of conservative voodoo economics have really ravaged this country. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us, 1-866-440-8466. Back with your calls right after this, 16 minutes past the hour. And welcome back. Help. Yes, indeed, my friends. Hold on tight to your dreams. The Tom Hartman radio program where despair is not an option. Get active. Tom Hartman here with you, helping you win the water cooler wars. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. By the way, I forgot to mention our quote for the day from Bucky Fuller, Buckminster Fuller, from his book, The Crunch of Giants. Corporations are neither physical nor metaphysical phenomena. They are socioeconomic ploys, legally enacted game playing, agreed upon only between overwhelmingly powerful socioeconomic individuals and by them imposed upon human society and all its unwitting members. Interesting quote for the day. Anyhow, Bernie, shall we take some calls here?
Let's do it.
Okay, 1-866-440-THOM, 440-8466, our number. Jeff in St. Louis, Missouri. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Fantastic. Good show.
Thank you.
I'm an independent. I've always basically felt that the Republicans push wealth up and the Democrats push wealth down, and the tension between the two made for a broad middle class, which is stability. When one or the other runs away with it, the middle class thins out and we get less stable. And so I think for years, you know, the Democrats were controlling things also, and we still lost a lot to outsourcing, not as fast as the Republicans, but still we were still losing. And I think the reason is because these election finance rules make it pretty much impossible for elected officials to represent people rather than special interests and corporations. Corporations want to pay slave wages. You know, if somebody passed legislation that said any foreign country or company that wants to import into the United States has to meet our labor, health, and pollution standards, what we would be doing...
Yeah, baby toast. Jeff, I understand. Is there a question there for Bernie?
Yeah, I guess
nice speech, but what's the question?
When do we get back in control? How do we get Congress?
Okay. Well, Jeff raises a good point. First of all, I think he puts his finger on one of the reasons that the middle class is declining. And I was just mentioning to Tom a moment ago about an article in the Wall Street Journal today which talks about Ford Motor Company shutting down plant after plant after plant in the United States. Thousands of good-paying jobs, ancillary jobs will be lost as well as they move to China. And Jeff is quite right. They're given the opportunity to move abroad, pay people pennies an hour. That's exactly what corporate America has done, will do, unless we develop policy to stop them. Tom, you'll remember something amazing. A few weeks ago, the Chinese government, actually, because of serious economic dissension within China, as the gap between the rich and the poor in China grows, they have passed legislation which will give unions the ability to begin to move into independent unions and stand up for their rights.
Yeah.
Do you know what corporate America said about that?
Not a good thing.
Here you have American corporations functioning in a communist authoritarian society, and they protest the fact that China is beginning to move to allow its workers some freedom to stand up for their rights. American corporations in opposition to that. And that's what Jeff's point is. Now, Jeff also says that Democrats have, under Democratic rule, outsourcing has also taken place, and he's absolutely right. The truth is now that I think many Democrats understand that NAFTA, permanent normal trade relations, were a mistake, that it is costing us millions of good-paying jobs. I certainly hope that if the Democrats gain control over the House or the Senate, that there will be a thorough rethinking of our trade policy. And the bottom line of this whole discussion is that corporate America obviously wants to sell its products in the United States of America, which is the most lucrative market on earth. Therefore, we have leverage, and we have the ability to say to them, you want to sell your products in America? You simply can't throw American workers out on the street and move abroad. You're going to have to start building some manufacturing capabilities in this country, and we're talking not just about blue-collar jobs. Let me tell you, we are on the verge of losing millions of good-paying white-collar jobs as well, unless we change our policies.
Yeah, well said. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Lee in Duval, Washington. Hey, Lee.
Hey, how you doing? I always look forward to this brunch with Bernie. It's a really good thing. Thanks for doing it.
Thank you.
Bernie, and you guys, democracy, the voting is so important for our democracy, and I want to know, Bernie, why hasn't a congressman introduced a bill to Congress prohibiting the private ownership and control of voting machines? Why can't it be like another government thing where you have a private industry can make it, but then they turn over or the government purchases from them, and then you establish a bipartisan commission to oversee the control of the voting machines? It seems like that's just a logical course that we should be taking right now.
Well, Lee, Tom and I have discussed this on many occasions, and you're quite right. It is beyond comprehension that private companies claim to have proprietary information regarding the voting machines that the public uses, and that's wrong. I think there is now increased skepticism, even among mainstream people, secretaries of state, Democrats and Republicans, about potential problems or problems that exist with touchscreen voting machines. I think we have to take a very hard look at it, and if necessary, go back to paper ballots if we're not comfortable with this new technology.
Yeah, it works fine for Canada. It works fine for Europe. You know, it's
right.
Paper.
Let's be safe rather than sorry.
Indeed.
If it takes a half hour more to count the ballots, so be it.
27 minutes past the hour. Our Brunch with Bernie segment, 866-440-8466. It's the Tom Hartman program. We'll be right back. How about the idea of peace on Earth? What happened to that? Welcome back to our program, listener-supported radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. How do our listeners support us? By supporting our sponsors, the sponsors you hear on your local affiliates, on the local radio station. Let them know you're listening. And also our national sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time, 1-800-425-2532, sacredgroundscoffee.com. And Small Dog Electronics. Get the latest iPods now, all things Macintosh, all things computer, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS, and smalldog.com, their website. 35 minutes past the hour, Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Brunch with Bernie, our Brunch with Bernie segment here. And Bernie, let's go to Gary in Youngstown, Ohio. Hey, Gary, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Thank you. If the makeup or the attitude of the next Congress were to change and their desire to undo some of the laws that have been put into place or undo some of the treaties were to be desired, how is that accomplished? What kind of a vote do they have to have the president's signature also on that to undo those?
Well, Gary raises an important point. The president can veto anything he wants, and it takes two-thirds in both houses to override a veto. But I think that what will happen for the first time since Bush has been president is the American people will be putting Bush on the spot and making his life very, very difficult if he is forced to veto legislation that is supported by the vast majority of the American people. Let him veto an effort to raise the national minimum wage above $5.15 an hour. Let him do that. I think he will look like a laughing stock, and he will be exposed for what he is. Let him veto legislation which begins to reverse our disastrous trade policies. One of the advantages of many that the president has by having a Republican House and Senate is not only that they are rubber stamping everything that he does, not only that they're not asking hard questions, they're not passing the kinds of legislation that needs to be passed and putting Bush on the spot.
Right, just to create the public discussion, if
right,
nothing else.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think that the political dynamic will change very significantly when you have real legislation, whether it's trade, whether it's environmental, whether it's economic and minimum wage, whether it's protecting our veterans. One of the issues that does not get discussed enough is that while this president keeps telling us how much he loves the men and women in the armed forces, he has a disastrous record in terms of protecting our veterans. He has thrown hundreds of thousands of Category 8 veterans off of VA health care, waiting lines all over this country for veterans. Hopefully, and the Democrats will pass serious legislation guaranteeing veterans the benefits that they deserve. Let the president veto that legislation. You know what? He's not going to do it.
Yeah. Let's get back to the phones here. We're totally slammed. Every line is full. Tom in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Bernie. Hi, Tom. Boy, so nice to have you on the air.
Well, thanks for listening to WPTT there in Pittsburgh, Tom.
I've got two very, very short questions. The first question is, and I'm really optimistic about the Democrats taking both the House and the Senate, but if it is the case that you take the House and not the Senate, will hearings, of course the Democrats can't make policy, can't answer that question, what would you do without having sworn testimony, would hearings in the House under testimony influence hearings in the Senate? Would they influence the Senate to bring in witnesses and put them under oath and ask questions so that we can finally get to the bottom of some of these things? Even with a Republican majority, can that happen?
Sure. I mean, anything can happen. It is generally assumed, I don't want to get into speculation, whether or not the Democrats take control of the Senate, we don't know, but most people think that they're going to gain some seats, so maybe it'll be 52-48, 51-49, maybe 50-50, with Cheney giving power to the Republicans. But if the Democrats in the House can begin to hold important hearings about Iraq, for example, what did the president know and when did he know it about weapons of mass destruction? Is it true that the intelligence agencies gave him bad intelligence, or in fact did he choose to cherry-pick the intelligence and ignore intelligence which suggested that Iraq did not have weapons of mass destruction or that Iraq was not allied with al-Qaeda? Very important. And if those hearings take place in the House, to answer Tom's question, I think that's going to reverberate in the Senate, and the Senate is going to have to do something to deal with some of the issues being raised in the House.
Or they'll be just totally exposed.
Yes.
Yeah, Chuck in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hey, Bernie. Hey, Tom.
Hey.
I just wanted to say that treaties can be a good thing, like maybe NAFTA and CAFTA. If you look at the differences between Clinton and Bush, if the president will trust and verify, just like in a nuclear treaty, you need to have a president that's enforcing treaties. They may, or the Kyoto Pact, like he's ignored that, and we need a president that will really work for us, like Clinton did. I remember when he doubled the tariff on Lexuses; those dealers were screaming, But it was effective in dealing with Japan and their trade policies with us, dumping on us.
Well, Chuck, let me say this. I mean, I think Clinton was a far, far, far superior president to Bush day and night, but on trade issues, he was not particularly good as well. I think the issue is here is trade is a good thing. Obviously, it's a good thing. But like any trade agreement, any trade relationships that one has, one has got to make sure that our side benefits at least equally. And the evidence is pretty overwhelming. When you have a $700 billion plus trade deficit, which is growing, $200 billion plus with China alone, which is growing, the loss of millions of good-paying jobs, our current trade agreements are not working well for the American people. So we have got to reconfigure these agreements and figure out how we can make trade work for ordinary people and not just the CEOs of large corporations.
Scott in Litchfield, Illinois, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yes, I got a comment that's actually linked to a question. My comment was, on your guys' talk about how that America cannot be an industrial superpower unless it has an industrial base. We cannot remain a superpower. The comment was that a gentleman wrote a book discussing exactly that, how an economy grows and why it doesn't. And the question is linked to that author of that book. Yeah, I'm wondering when.
Are you talking about what I was talking about yesterday? The
no,
German.
No, you were talking about it earlier. How America cannot remain a superpower without an industrial base.
Yes.
We have to have an industrial base.
Yes.
We have to have somebody, a factory building guns, building bullets. We can't keep relying on Japan and China to ship us parts for our own military to fight them someday.
That's right, Scott. I mean, you're absolutely right.
My question is actually totally different. On the author of that book, Irwin Schiff, when is Congress or Senate going to start telling the IRS to enforce the law as it's written, with the Broussard decision, the Arthur Farnsworth decision in Pennsylvania, how income means profit? Why are they continually trying to convince the American public that their wages are somehow profit? Is Congress ever going to step up? I mean, I know in 1954 they took the words wages, salaries, and compensation for personal services out of the definition of gross income. But the IRS continues to ignore that. They continue to try to convince the American public that somehow them working, they have to be an indentured servant, that they have to pay for the right to work in the United States.
Yeah.
That's not a...
Yeah, I'm sorry, we lost Scott. I think that Scott is getting into kind of the minutiae of the argument about the Fed and the IRS and all that kind of stuff, but there's a larger issue here, Bernie.
Well, I mean, the larger issue is the first point that he made, and he's right in saying that it's not just a general economic issue. It comes down to national security as well, and you have a lot of conservative Republicans in the Congress, I should say, who are very concerned that we are becoming more and more dependent upon other countries for our weapons and the mechanisms that we need to defend our country. So
yeah.
it is a huge issue.
How bizarre is it when a Chinese general threatens to nuke us and we can't build a nuclear weapon without Chinese chips? I mean, it's just the irony is tragic, frankly. Chris in San Francisco, California, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi there, Bernie. I want to thank you for coming on here every week. It's my favorite hour on the program every week.
Thank you, Chris.
And I've got a very interesting question for you. If the Democrats get within one vote of taking the Senate, or one seat from taking the Senate, would you consider maybe becoming Democrat to, cement that?
I'm going to be supporting the Democratic leadership. Of course, I have done that and always voted for the Democratic leadership in the 8 terms that I've been in the House, and I certainly will do that in the Senate.
So you're caucusing with the Democrats, so effectively for political purposes, it's happening on that side.
Yeah, and ironically, Vermont right now has the only independent in the Senate, and that's Senator Jim Jeffords, who is retiring, and he has an independent caucuses with the Democrats, and I would do the same.
Yeah. Steve in Kent, Washington, you're live with Bernie Sanders. And we have about a minute before I have to take a break. Steve, you there? Nope, Steve is not there. Okay, let's try Richard, driving in California, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Richard.
Hey, Tom, Bernie, I'd like to say you guys are two great Americans.
Thank you.
My question is, this September 19th, the treaty that was between North Korea and this, I don't know, 6 nations or 5 nations, How can we get away with, doing what we did? We threw Korea under the bus, and nobody's saying anything about it.
Threw South Korea under the bus, you mean?
No, we had a treaty with North Korea signed on September 19th. It was in Newsweek International.
Oh, yeah, I remember. We'll have to get Bernie's take on that when we come back on the other end of the break. Richard, thank you for the call, the whole issue of North Korea. 45 minutes past the hour. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us, the independent from Vermont. Our phone number, 866-440-8466. We'll be right back.
Understand,
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Our Brunch with Bernie segment, Congressman Bernie Sanders with us, the independent member of Congress from the great state of Vermont, and Diana in Santa Rosa Beach, Florida. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi. Good to talk to you again. You know, you're talking about the American industrial base. Recently, for my business, I invested in two cars, two trucks, made by Hoosiers, under foreign management. I have water closets in my house, toilets, made by Americans, under foreign management. My hardware is a small hardware factory. Everything's made in the United States. It's a family-owned business. My question to you is, the American worker seems to do fine work if he's given proper management. I think we are outsourcing the wrong end of our labor pool. I think we need to outsource the $5 and $6 million CEOs, get people back in that are more reasonable.
Yeah.
Well, you raise a very interesting question, Diana. And it seems to me that what has gone on in this country for the last few decades is that the people on the top, the CEOs of large corporations, have lost their identification with American workers, with the middle class, and in fact with the United States of America. At some point, what they said is, what is important is for us, the people on top, to make as much money as we possibly can, obscene salaries, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars a year, maybe, as is the case right now, 400 times more than our workers. And if we have to break unions, we will do that. If we have to move to China or Mexico, we will do that, because all that is important is for us to have as much money as we possibly can. And I think there is a culture now within corporate America that says that the future of America is not what's most important. It's profits and wealth for the people on top. And I think that that is an ethic and a culture that has got to be radically changed. I don't have any problem with people making money. They, you know, people work hard, they make money, that's fine. But they should not be selling out the American people. And that is just a cultural issue that we have got to address.
You know, Diana raises another point, Bernie, and that is that because we are buying about $1.5 billion a day more from overseas than we're selling to overseas, all these companies and countries and individuals and countries outside the United States are sitting on all these dollars, and they're using those dollars to buy up American industry.
Right. No, I heard that. Yep.
And so, you know, it's what happens, the profits end up going to Japan, the profits go to Germany, the profits go someplace else. I mean, that's another issue as well. Anyhow, Steve,
and you see the extreme manifestation of that in the Dubai Ports World effort to take off some of our ports.
Yeah, indeed. Steve in Kent, Washington. Hey, Steve, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hey, Bernie.
Hey, Steve.
First of all, best of luck in your election.
Thank you very much.
Next, the United States is number one in only three categories that I can figure out. One of them is contributing to global warming. Another one is spending money on the military. And the final one, and I find most shocking, what I'd like you to comment about, is prison population. We have over 2 million people in prison. The next highest number is China with 1.5 million. And on a per capita basis, we surpassed Russia, who has 713 people per 100,000. We have 740. Germany has 98, Italy 92, France 80. Please comment on that.
Well, I can't verify the statistics that you've mentioned, but I do know that we have a shocking number of people in prison. I think it speaks to the fact that rather investing in education, I think it speaks to the fact that we have the highest rate of childhood poverty in the industrialized world, that there are millions and millions of people today existing outside of the mainstream of American society, people who get off on the wrong track when they are 5 years of age, 6 years of age. Police officers in cities and towns all over America can tell you exactly the kids who are going to end up in jail. And it would seem to me that it would be more important for us to start investing in child care, early childhood education, better understanding why so many people are becoming poor, why so many people are growing up outside of the mainstream, reaching out to those families and making sure that we do everything that we can to provide the education, the health care, and the other programs which will allow people to understand that living productive lives as taxpayers, as workers, makes a lot more sense than self-destructive and destructive activities. But what you're talking about is a huge issue. It speaks poorly of us as a nation. And by the way, keeping 2 million people in jail at whatever it is, $25,000, $30,000 a year, is a pretty expensive proposition. And if we put that money in trying to help people become productive when they're kids, we would probably end up saving a lot of money for taxpayers.
Great. We have less than a minute left. Andy in Buffalo, New York. Quick question for Bernie.
Yeah, I enjoy you guys' show. Every Friday you guys have lunch with Bernie. I really enjoy it. My question for Bernie is real simple. Why is it, does it seem like middle-class Americans that live in the rural areas like where I live, you know, they seem to be voting Republicans in office when they're the ones, a few corporate Democrats are outsourcing us all.
Yeah. Bernie, we got about 20 seconds. You can answer it.
Well, you're right. Rural America is much more conservative. But I think if you watch this election, I think you're going to begin to see that changing.
Well, and in fact, Brian Schweitzer in Montana, you in Vermont, I mean, you
right.
carry the rural areas all the time. I mean, rural Americans get it when you speak honestly to them.
Yep.
Congressman Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Always
Take
great
care.
Having
Bye-bye.
You on the program. It's 56 minutes past the hour. Coming up in the next hour, Dan Gaynor is going to be here. He's the director of the Business and Media Institute. He's going to tell us why Americans think the economy is so bad. Yeah, it's the media. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Paul Craig Roberts, the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration, a lifelong Republican, still a Republican, an editor at the Wall Street Journal, recently wrote, "During the past 5 years, January 01 to January 06, the information sector of the U.S. economy lost 644,000 jobs, or 17.4% of its workforce. Computer systems design and related work cost lost 105,000 jobs, or 8.5% of its workforce. U.S. manufacturing lost 2.9 million jobs, almost 17% of the manufacturing workforce. The wipeout is across the board. Not a single manufacturing payroll classification created a single new job. The declines in some manufacturing sectors have more in common with a country undergoing saturation bombing during war than with a super economy that is the envy of the world. In 5 years, the communications equipment sector lost 42% of its workforce. Semiconductors and electronic components lost 37% of their workforce. The workforce in computers and electronic products declined 30%. Electrical equipment and appliances lost 25%. Workforce in motor vehicles and parts declined 12%. And Ford just announced they're laying off 30,000 more people. Furniture and related products lost 17%. Textiles, 43%. Paper lost one-fifth of its job. Plastics, 15%. In the five-year period of the Bush administration, the U.S. job growth was limited to four areas: education and health service, state and local government, leisure and hospitality, and financial services, and, of course, the military. Over in Germany, Gaber Steingart, the editor of Der Spiegel, the Newsweek of Europe, of the German Newsweek, and one of the most influential publications in Europe, writes, "U.S. economic growth is, in fact, fueled by ever-increasing consumer spending, puzzling, given that American wages are dropping, as is industrial output. Still, everyone knows the answer to the riddle. The rise in consumption is not based on an expansion of production. It's not based on a rise in wages. It's not even based on an increase in exports. To a large extent, it's based on growing debt. Almost no one is saving money in the United States today. The U.S. foreign debt grows by $1.5 billion every weekday and has now reached $3 trillion. Private household debt, both at home and abroad, has reached $9 trillion, and 40% of these debts have been incurred since George W. Bush took office. The Americans are enjoying the present at the cost of selling off ever larger chunks of their future. Arguably, the imminent economic crisis is the most thoroughly predicted one in the history of the world. Into this steps Dan Gaynor of the Business and Media Institute. He's the director of the Business and Media Institute, businessandmedia.org, their website. And Dan, you suggest that the reason why the average American thinks the economy is not going all that well is not because of the statistics that I just shared with our listeners, but because the media is liberal.
Let's try a few other statistics first before we get into this.
Okay.
How about, on average, 180,000 jobs created each month since the Bush recovery, August 2003. That works out to about 6.6 million new jobs. Even your most left-wing economist says we need about 150,000 jobs each month. 180,000 works out to about a million extra jobs during that time period.
Okay, compare that with the Clinton years.
Okay, not compare the Clinton years. I'm talking about, is it a good economy? It's
a good economy. So we're creating lots of jobs as Walmart greeters and in the services economy. Would you like fries with that? I don't think the average American's buying it, Dan.
Okay, how about since the fall of 2004, the U.S. gross domestic product has increased by $1.3 trillion. That also sounds good. How about 4.6% unemployment? Also sounds good.
You realize the unemployment numbers in this country, in the second year of the Bush administration, they changed it to where if you're employed as much as 1 hour a week, you are considered employed now by this government.
If you want to talk about good economy, you're talking about the United States economy. You're talking about the Dow at records. You're talking about the NASDAQ.
Well, the Dow and NASDAQ indicate how the investor class is doing.
Well,
in fact, what you see is that company stocks go up when they lay people off.
Investor class is more than half of America.
No, there are fewer than 4% of Americans who actually earn the majority of their income from investment.
You don't have to earn the majority of your income to be part of the investor class.
Just because somebody has some stock in a 401k because their pension got wiped out because the corporations decided to downsize the pensions and throw people into 401ks doesn't make them part of the investor class.
It absolutely does. If my retirement, and my retirement is, by the way, in part of a, it's a 403b, it's the same thing, it's a nonprofit version. My retirement, everybody who's listening right now has got money in a 401k, mutual fund, retirement. I said,
I don't.
Just because you're a lot wealthier probably than I am.
No, I'm not.
All those people who are part of the stock market, they benefit when the stock market does well, and they don't benefit when the stock market does badly.
No, it's not. It's simply not true. What happens is what we have seen since, when Reagan came into office, the market was around 3,000. It was 2,500, something like that. The Dow, that was an all-time high. The Dow is now pushing 13,000. We've seen over 26 years the Dow has exploded, whereas in the 100 years prior to that, the Dow slowly rose from around 119, around 1900, up to around 1,000 in the 1980s or in the late 1970s. And as the Dow has gone up, the wages of average working people have gone down. What we've seen is a massive shift in wealth from wages to investment. Kevin Phillips, the Republican, Kevin Phillips writes about this in his most recent book. We're all about arbitrage now. Right now, the United States, more money is made in the United States moving money around than is made manufacturing products. That has never happened in the history of this country. And every country in the history of the world where that has happened, it has been followed by a hyperinflationary crash like happened in the Weimar Republic in Germany in the 1920s.
How come you've got the New York Times reporting in August that there's been a surge of wage and salary income in the first half of this year? The way typically things work in an economy when you have a recession, we all admit we did, we have a recession, usually you have expansion, companies do better, then employees do better next. What's happening is employers are indeed spending a lot more on their employees.
Dan, why is it that from the 1940s to the 1980s, the golden era of the American middle class, when we had a 90% top marginal tax rate, when we had tariffs that kept domestic jobs domestic, we still made clothes in the United States, we still made TVs in the United States, we made pretty much everything here because imported goods were more costly, that during that period of time, one person working, like my dad, working in a tool and die shop in Lansing, Michigan, with a union wage, was able to raise four boys, put kids through college, have full Blue Cross and Blue Shield, and a pension right up until the day he died a few months ago, and have the middle class dream, whereas now for somebody to have that quality of life and buy a home and have a car, you know, buy a new car every 4 or 5 years. But for somebody now to have that quality of life, both people in the family have to work. That change has only happened since Ronald Reagan came into office, declared war on working people in the United States, and started voodoo economics, where we went from $1 trillion in national debt to now $8 trillion in national debt. Radical conservative economic policies have bankrupted this nation.
That's a historical fantasy. You want to roll back the clock to a time when we didn't have a global economy. Well, guess what? We have a global economy.
It was a global economy then. You could buy products from overseas, and we were shipping products overseas. In fact, we were the largest exporter of goods in the world in 1980 when Reagan came into office. Today, we are the largest importer of goods in the world. We've gone from being a first-world nation, a manufacturing nation, to being a third-world consuming nation. In 26 years.
Manufacturing always moves to areas of lower wages.
No, it doesn't. For 210 years in the United States, it did not, because we had tariffs that said, if you want to make a pair of shoes.
Around the United States then, now thanks to the unions that you were just advocating for.
This has nothing to do with the unions. This has to do with trade policy.
But also has to do with unions. When unions have priced American goods out of the market. Yeah, then what's happened is American companies have had no choice but to go to
I get it. Okay, so to hell with the middle class. These people, they think that they should be able to raise their kids and buy a middle class home in a middle class neighborhood on you know, $16-18 an hour, $20 an hour these days, working at General Motors. They should just be happy with their $8 an hour at Walmart. To hell with them.
You're talking about an economy right now that is so strong that anybody, almost anybody, has a college education has a job. The unemployment rate for people who
almost anybody who has a college education also has $40,000 in debt. They're an indentured servant.
Indentured servant? You make a choice anytime you put.
Dan, in 1968, I could work my way through college working at $2.30 an hour as a disc jockey and for a while working in a gas station changing tires. My wife worked her way through college as a waitress in a Howard Johnson's. You tell me that can be done today?
I can tell you anything. You can certainly acquire loans and do it. I mean,
no, I did not acquire loans. And I went to, we're talking, you know, real colleges and real universities. It has changed.
Think things are worse now than they were then?
Yes.
I mean, look at our quality of life. My gosh, the technology, the medical advances, the way we live is so much better.
We have fancier machines, and we've got people driving nice cars, and they are so deeply in debt that the smallest hiccup in our economy is going to throw millions of people out on the streets.
Well, funny, we've had a lot of small hiccups the last year, and we haven't thrown millions of people out of work.
The headline today, the screaming headline at the top of the San Francisco Chronicle, I'm broadcasting live from San Francisco, Bay Area foreclosures on the rise, adjustable loans a growing threat.
We had Hurricane Katrina. We still had positive job growth during the months of Hurricane Katrina hit. You think that through millions of work and the economy collapsed, somehow it didn't happen.
Okay, Dan Gaynor, if you want to learn more about it, go over to businessandmedia.org. He's the director of the Business and Media Institute. Dan, good talking with you today.
Always a good time.
16, thanks. Yeah, thank you. 16 minutes past the hour.
Lonely feelings deep inside. Find a corner where I can hide. Silent footsteps crowding me. Sudden darkness. But I can see. No sugar tonight in my coffee. No sugar tonight in my tea. No sugar to stand beside me. No sugar to run.
And welcome back, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Our telephone number 1-866-440-8466, 440-THOM, and our website, TomHartman.com. However you spell it, we'll get you there if you want to drop into our live chat room. The headline in the San Francisco Chronicle, and I'm sure similar ones are happening all over the United States. This is just specific to San Francisco. It's written by Marnie Leff Cottle, a Chronicle staff writer. Marnie writes, falling prices, sluggish sales, and mortgages that let borrowers pile up debt faster than they can pay it off could put more Bay Area homeowners out of their houses this year than at any other time this decade. By the end of September, 865 homeowners in the 9 Bay Area counties had lost their homes through foreclosure sales, easily surpassing the 529 borrowers whose homes were repossessed in all of last year, according to DataQuick Real Estate Information Service. as borrowers who signed up for mortgages that started with low monthly rates face higher payments in the next 2 years. Economists predict the situation will worsen. And this is, you'll recall, I mean, those of you who've been listening to the program for any of the 3 years, 3.5 years that we've been on the air, I have consistently said, if you're going to buy a house with a mortgage, and that's how most people buy a house with a mortgage, get as short a period of time as possible. Try to get a 15 or 20 year mortgage and get a fixed rate. I know it's going to cost more, but you'll be generating equity in the home. You'll be paying it down, and they're not going to be able to play games with you of, the interest rates just went up. So did your payments. This is just one more symptom of how the middle class is getting screwed in America. It is absolutely endemic, and how the financial interests in this country, who have bought and sold Congress, want to make sure that their butts are covered. They passed, you'll recall this obscene bankruptcy legislation last year that said that if you have $5 million or more, you can create an asset protection trust, and you can have a bankruptcy. You can have a Donald Trump bankruptcy. Yes, Donald Trump declared bankruptcy in Las Vegas. You can have a Donald Trump bankruptcy, and you're in pretty good shape. But if you're not a multimillionaire and you declare bankruptcy, it's going to be really tough. It's still possible, but it's going to be really tough. And these interests, not just the financial interests, but you've got the polluting interests, you've got the drug companies who want to make sure that the prices that we're paying for pharmaceuticals, I mean literally all of us, because we are paying them through Medicare, and that is being taken out of our paychecks, out of our taxes. The prices that are paid for drugs by all of us are full retail, rather than having the government having the ability to negotiate drug prices. We are the only industrialized country in the world that has no national health care program. Even worse, we're the only industrialized country in the world, and we may be the only country in the world. I've actually seen that in two articles now. I haven't been able to verify it, that we're the only country in the world that has a law that requires the government, when it buys drugs on behalf of people in particular programs, in this case Medicare, to pay full retail rather than buy them at wholesale. I mean, the only reason they haven't extended this to the Veterans Administration is because it would break the bank so badly and so quickly. The VA budget, I mean, it would just wipe it out. The VA, the Veterans Administration, they run hospitals all over the United States. They go to the pharmaceutical companies and they say, okay, we know that your price is a buck a pill for, brand X, for pill X, drug X. It's a dollar a pill if I buy them retail. If you go into a drugstore and you just buy them, with a prescription, one at a time or five at a time or a month's worth. But we're going to buy 20 million of them because we've got a whole lot of vets who are taking this particular medication. What's your price on 20 million? And the drug companies say, well, if you're going to buy 20 million, we have economies of scale. We can crank up the production lines. We can package in bulk for you. We'll drop the price down to 10 cents a pill instead of a dollar a pill. Cool. 90% discount or whatever it is. You can buy it wholesale instead of buying it retail. But Medicare, no, they have to buy it retail. And so another headline from today's San Francisco Chronicle is by Tom Corno, the Chronicle Sacramento Bureau. The headline, Orgy of Spending on Political Ads. Now, this is just in California. $500 million breaks state record. This is in an off-term election, a midterm election. More than $500 million has been spent so far in the 2006 state election, a figure that shatters previous records and bewilders voters and advocates for changes in campaign finance law. It doesn't bewilder me. What you are seeing is those interests representing wealth and power in the United States, wealth and the power of wealth, stepping forward and saying, we have to maintain control of the political process. Because the political process, that's what they're saying, that because the political process is where the rules of the game are set. And the rules of the game right now are rigged in favor of big multinational corporations and company like Halliburton's KBR that reincorporated outside the United States. So the obscene profits that they're making in Iraq with 30, 40, 50% overhead, they don't even have to pay U.S. income taxes on it. But you and I do. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with your calls right after this. Tom. America. And welcome back. Defending America from the Conservative Weapons of Mass Deception. Tom Hartman here with you. And we are, you know, you are hearing me bounced off a satellite 20,000 miles up in space. It's pretty amazing when you think about it. You know, it's just, it's incredible. 700 miles, a new fence okayed for a Mexican border. Again, I'm looking for just the front page of today's paper here in San Francisco. I could do an entire show just off the front page. Capping a year of raucous debate, rancorous debate over illegal immigration and border security. Tyke Hendricks writing about this. President Bush signed a bill Thursday authorizing 700 miles of new double-layer steel fencing along the U.S.-Mexico border, a move Republicans hope will give them a pre-election boost. Yeah. Again, this feeds back into the death of the middle class. Back in 1814, David Ricardo, one of the most famous economists in history, wrote what today would probably be called a pamphlet or a booklet. It was, you know, I don't know, 50, 60 pages, something like that. A small book. It was called On Labor, in which he made one major point. He made it very well, and he made it repeatedly, but he made one major point, and that was that the price of labor, in other words, wages, will only rise above a subsistence level. In other words, the working poor. Working people will only rise above the working poor and become the middle class under one circumstance. And that is if the demand for labor exceeds the supply. In other words, if there are fewer people out there available to work than the market wants, and then the price of labor goes up, and thus you have a middle class. And that's why progressives fought to have child labor laws, to keep children out of the marketplace from competing with adults, to drive up the cost of labor. It's why they fought for unionization, so that they could essentially reduce the supply of labor within individual companies and drive up the cost of labor. It's why they fought for a 5-day work week instead of a 6-day or 7-day work week, to drive down the number of hours that were worked, thus driving up the demand for labor. It's why they fought for a 40-hour work week. It's why they fought for time and a half laws. And it's one of the reasons why historically labor has, they haven't since 2002, tragically, but historically labor has supported laws saying that immigration into the United States will be limited to the number of people coming into this country who are coming for legitimate reasons, like, you know, they're married to somebody in this country, or they're refugees, or they have special skills that we need, or, you know, and on top of that, some basic number that we need in order to grow the country to in relation to the economy, but not so many that it will drive down the cost of labor by driving up the availability of labor. Illegal immigration is all about destroying the middle class. This is why Ronald Reagan pushed through in 1986 the amnesty for illegal immigrants here in the United States. And these guys are running around, these right-wing Republicans, whose buddies in corporate America are making so much money off the fact that wages in the United States are collapsing in small part. Not this, you know, if there are some folks who want to characterize illegal immigration as the whole cause for the... No, it's just in some small part. Because the labor supply, the labor force in the United States is being diluted. And so what's their solution? Is it to stop the magnet that draws people here from other countries who are willing to risk life, literally willing to risk death, losing their life, going through the deserts of the Southwest to get a job? No. It's let's build a fence. Yeah, right. Fences have never worked. I'm sorry. They don't work. I used to live on the East German border back in 1986. In the spring, when the ground was thawing and the sun would come up in the morning, as the ground thawed and moved, the landmines along the East German border would go off spontaneously. I'd wake up in the morning to boom, boom, just, you know, 300-500 yards away from where we lived. Or where I was staying. This is in Hirchheim, Germany, one of two Salem communities. It's a whole long story. In any case, when I was living there. I mean, that's, if you want to have a fence, that's what you've got to do. 2 20-foot-high walls with barbed wire, with sand in the middle. Every 400 or 500 yards, there's a machine gun emplacement and landmines. This is sick. We don't need a fence. We need to put some employers in jail. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Melissa in Seattle. Hey, Melissa, what's on your mind today?
Well, I was calling to comment. The gentleman that you had on earlier was discussing how management's attitude about they're going to take more money and it's somehow going to benefit the workers. Well, my union rep was in a contract bargaining, and the management's attitude was, it is not the responsibility of this company to pay a living wage.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You know? It is, and in fact, that's legally true right now in the United States. That was not legally true in the United States prior to Reagan, mm-hmm. back when the National Labor Relations Board was actually enforcing the laws, the NLRB law of 1935. But since
right.
Reagan, with the exception of a few years under Clinton when Robert Reich was doing a pretty good job as labor secretary, basically for 26 years, the legal requirement of a corporation now is to maximize stockholder value, to maximize stockholder equity, which means
right.
make the investing class richer. And to hell with the working class, they are simply a commodity. In fact, we now refer to employees as human resources rather than as employees or as labor or as workers or as people who are producing things.
Well, yeah, and in the meantime, I had been the sole salary earner in my household. My husband was laid off 2.5 years ago. He just got a job, thank goodness. But I was supposed to support my family on my wage, which isn't a living wage. In the meantime, I've always, always, always been able to pay my bills. We had to declare bankruptcy. We had to do all kinds of other stuff that I never, ever in a million years thought I'd have to do. And it killed me to have to do it. But it's the norm now. It's what they have pushed us into doing.
That's right. This is the new normal America. We're mm-hmm. sliding back into Victorian era economics. It's like the Victorian era in England, where you had a very small middle class, and Scrooge and Marley were actually part of the middle class, the shop owners, the small business owners. Scrooge owned a two-person company, him and his employee Bob Cratchit. You have a very small middle class, you have a very small ruling class, and fabulously wealthy, and you have a very large class of the working poor. Bob Cratchit and his family, and the working poor are saying, you know, please, please give us health care for Tiny Tim. No, you can't. It'll cost me a pence. And Scrooge actually, I mean, you know, as the middle class, as a small businessman, he was stuck too, right? He ended up being, you know, a little more magnanimous in the end of the story. But the fact of the matter is, Dickens understood this. His own father was thrown into debtor's prison. He understood how economics works in an absolute laissez-faire world. And that's what these cons are bringing us in the United States. And over the last 26 years, we have seen the absolute destruction of the American middle class. It's picking up steam so rapidly now. And even if you want to get it, I mean, the disparity between the ability to earn a middle class wage with a high school diploma versus a college degree has become so great. And at the same time, in order to get a college degree, you have to become an indentured servant, unless you're part of the investor class, the very wealthy in America. And it is, you know, and this is not, I am not saying this out of anger or out of jealousy or out of class warfare. I mean, I have started a number of businesses in my life. There have been times when I've made a lot of money. There have been times when I had no money. And, you know, I've been on both sides of this thing. My concern is that when you have such huge class disparities, economic class disparities, it is not good for democracy. You don't end up with an informed populace. You don't end up with the social mobility necessary for a democratic society. And ultimately, you end up with people who will vote for demagogues who will lead them into crazed wars because, you know, that's all they're thinking about.
Right.
And
well,
it's just,
one last thought on my part was,
yeah.
I don't understand who they think is going to buy all the products that they're importing at this point if we can't even afford to feed our children.
Well, and that's the point of the piece in Der Spiegel that I was sharing with you yesterday, is that the orgy of purchasing of imported goods in the United States is being financed by debt. People are taking money out of their homes. The value of homes has been going up. They've been turning their homes into ATM machines.
Right.
And they're buying things on debt, thinking that the economy is going to last forever, and it's not. And, right. and the appreciation of the value of homes is not going to last forever. And a lot of people are getting caught right now, and it's a tragedy. It's a true tragedy, Melissa.
It is. It is.
Thank you for the call. Yeah, good to hear from you. Well, we got to take a break here in a second. We'll pick up a few more calls on the other side of it. But this is just you see how this all fits together. This is all one piece of cloth. It's called conservative economics. It's what George Herbert Walker Bush. Bush the Elder referred to as voodoo economics. The idea that if we all just get out of the way, no rules of the game at all, just let the CEOs run everything, let the businesses, after all, they know best, right? What, they wouldn't be making $400 million a year in salaries if they didn't know best. Just let them take care of it, and everything will be fine. And he said, this is nuts! And he was right. Here we are now. 26 years later, $8 trillion in debt. That's $28,000 per family, per person in the United States. And heading toward bankruptcy as a nation. 45 minutes past the hour.
Where did my ballot go?
And welcome back to the vast radical middle conspiracy. Take no imitations, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Ellen Ratner with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen, what's up?
Oh, well, actually, there's a lot of news. First of all, the president is going to move hard. He's going to move away from his little fundraising trips. And right before the election, he's going to be going for very, very big rallies. And that is the focus of what they're going to do. They're trying to rev up the base so that the base can get out there. Also, some pretty good news. It looks like the Senatorial Campaign Committee and the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee are almost par. They have near parity with about... $8 or $9 million each on hand. The Congressional Campaign Committee has about $17 million in the bank. Why they're not loosening the change, I don't know. The Republicans have $18 million. It's only the Democratic National Committee. They brought in about $10 million for the period. They have $400 million on hand, but they also have debts of $4 million. The RNC has $21 million in the bank. So the real disparity is between the RNC Central Committee and the DNC.
Interesting. Okay.
So that's what's sort of happening on fundraising. Now, also, why am I not surprised, but the gross domestic product growth actually slowed to 1.6% in the third quarter. They had well expected it to be 2.2 in the third quarter, and that did not happen. Also, then there was a whole big discussion this morning about waterboarding. The White House, this is actually from my one of my stations, Scott Hennen, asked at his interview with Dick Cheney about waterboarding, and Cheney said, "Well, if a dunk in the water is no brainer, if it can save lives, that's what Scott asked." And then Cheney said, "Well, it's a no brainer for me. For a while, I was criticized for being vice president of torture. We don't torture. That's not what we're involved in. But if waterboarding does not define it, I don't know what is." So then this morning at the gaggle, they said, "Well, what is waterboarding? What is a dunk in the water?" And all Tony Snow would say, "Well, it's a dunk in the water."
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I mean, it boggles the mind.
Yeah, this is where they strap you to a board and you can't move. They tilt you, they incline you, so your head is about 3 feet below your feet. So your feet are up in the air and your head is down, and then they pour water over your face. And you are struggling to breathe. And they're saying, "We'll keep pouring this water until you tell us what you, and you're drowning. You're drowning."
Exactly.
And they try to stop before you drown or before you die. But we know that over 37 people we know of died under, quote, rough interrogation, end quote, at Abu Ghraib and other prisons in Afghanistan
and
Iraq.
Well, and bringing people up to the ceiling and, I mean, all kinds of stuff where they did die.
Yeah, Yeah, and you know, the pictures of the body are the bodies are out there, and yet these guys are pretending that it never happened. It's just mind-boggling.
And the White House is denying that they're doing this, even though Cheney clearly admitted.
Yeah, it's incredible. Whoops. Sorry, Ellen, I popped you over to the wrong side of the board.
That is, by anybody's definition, Mr. Hartman, that is war crimes.
Yeah. Mr. Hartman was my dad, Ellen.
Ah.
But you're right. You're right. You're absolutely right. Ellen, I'm gonna get back to some of my callers. Thank you for the update.
Thank you.
Talk Radio News Service today, talkradionews.com, great source of information from Washington, D.C. Rico in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Rico, what's on your mind today?
Well, I want to make a comment on the proposed fence on the border between the United States and Mexico.
Sure.
It's a little unusual, so bear with me. I'll try to be concise.
Well, it's going to have to be tight. We have about 40 seconds left.
Okay. Basically, Mexico and countries in Central America have used the border, an open border, to have people come north to earn money to send remittances back to their home countries.
Sure.
The border fence, in my opinion, will inhibit those people from coming up and cause a great deal of pressure in those societies. And as we know, Mexico right now is society is undergoing some very significant stress.
No, I agree with you. What will happen is, for example, we've got 13 million to 20 million Mexicans in the United States right now. If they'd been in Mexico, they probably would have voted for the progressive candidate. You're right. It will produce that kind of effect. But why should we spend hundreds of billions of dollars to Halliburton and Bechtel to build a fence when we could produce the exact same result in terms of people no longer coming north simply by putting employers in jail who hire them?
Well, there you are. And also the thing is that it's the law of unintended consequences. It's the last thing the United States wants to see is a very unstable left-leaning Mexico.
Right, and that's why they're going to do this song and dance about, well, we're going to build a fence, but gee, it's not really a fence. Well, it's going to be secure, but it's not going to be secure. It's going to be a few hundred billion dollars for Bechtel and Halliburton and our good buddies. You know, they're going to make out, but it's not going to cover the entire border. I mean, we got a 2,000-mile border or something. Well, it's not 2,000, it's over 1,000-mile border. We're talking a 700-mile fence, and then you read the fine print, and you discover that it's not even a fence, and they haven't actually appropriated the money for it, and a large part of it is just, you know, surveillance and monitors and things. And you know, come on, it's like one of the Democratic members of Congress said, you know, you show me a 12-foot fence, I'll show you a 13-foot ladder. I mean, you really think this is going to stop anybody? You know, we have chunks of fence now. Yeah, it slows down people in specific areas. But if you don't stop the magnet that is driving down wages in the United States and causing impoverished and in many cases terrified people from the South to come north, they're going to keep on coming. And that's not good for those societies. It's not good for Mexican society that the second leading source of income for that country is remittances from people working here with family in Mexico. It's not good for Mexico. It's not good for the United States. It's not a healthy thing. Individual countries and individual societies need to operate as self-organizing, self-sustaining organisms, for lack of a better word. Economies. Nations. Gee, what a concept. The nation state. 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Harkin.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the real Free Speech Zone, the Tom Hartman radio program. Samuel Adams, our quote B for the day, if you love wealth better than liberty, the tranquility of servitude better than the animating contest of freedom, go from us in peace. We do not ask your counselor arms. Crouch down and lick the hands which feed you. May your chains sit lightly upon you, and may posterity forget that you were ever our countrymen. Yeah, Samuel Adams speaking to the conservatives of his day who did not want to fight a war with the British for independence in America. Stephen Gray is with us. Ghostplane.net, the website. He's the author of a new book, Ghost Plane, the true story of the CIA torture program. Stephen Gray, welcome to the Tom Hartman program here.
Hi, it's a pleasure.
Well, let's just start. Ghost Plane. Why do you call it Ghost Plane?
I call it Ghost Plane because what I did was use the movements of these CIA planes, which I managed to track down around the world, to uncover the story of these renditions, these transfers of prisoners to countries in the Middle East, particularly, where, you know, torture is prevalent and where many prisoners have been tortured.
Any sense of how many people have been rendered to countries where they would be tortured, and how many of them may have died or simply never reappeared as a consequence of those renditions?
Well, it's in the hundreds. I mean, that's what people in the CIA say, the low hundreds. That's what they say. But, you know, there are actually hundreds and hundreds of more prisoners that have just disappeared. We don't know where they are. I mean, the most important thing is there's been no accountability. The whole process has been done in secret. There were thousands of people captured in Afghanistan. Many of them were released, but hundreds of others have just disappeared off the face of the earth.
And they're still gone.
And it still goes on. I mean, it's been under threat because of the Supreme Court, you know, made a ruling that the president needs to follow the Geneva Conventions. And there's a lot of anger in Europe about these things. But the recent legislation just passed, in a way, gives this whole thing a new lease of life because, you know, the habeas corpus has now been removed. So all these people have disappeared. Their friends, their families, anyone associated with them have got no means of taking a legal action to actually find out where they are and what's happened to them.
Are we talking about people who were simply captured on the battlefield, to quote the Bush administration, in Afghanistan or Iraq? Or are we, you know, I understand that there have been people walking down the street in Germany, walking down the street in France, walking down the street maybe in the United States of America, snatched, and they show up in Syria in a torturer's cells.
Well, there was a Canadian who changed planes at John F. Kennedy Airport. He went to Syria. There was a man picked up in Milan, Italy, walking down the street. He was sent to Egypt. So, yes, quite a few were picked up in Afghanistan. But, you know, the majority of people that I've come across were picked up in places around the world. And, you know, you only have to look at Guantanamo there. They always say these are people picked up on the battlefield. But, you know, the surveys of all the people there have shown the majority were not picked up in Afghanistan at all. They were picked up in mostly Pakistan, other places, where, you know, they didn't have a gun in their hand at all. And to call them, soldiers combatants is a real stretch.
Stephen Gray, the author of Ghost Plane, the true story of the CIA torture program, ghostplane.net, the website. Stephen, how do you respond to, I'm reluctant to call them conservative or even right-wing critics, let's say pro-torture critics, or anti-democratic rule of law critics, or whatever. How do you respond to folks who say, you know, these guys aren't playing by the rules of warfare. This is an asymmetrical war, in quotes, and therefore any means is useful to accomplish the end of securing America.
Well, you know, I'm a reporter, and I try to expose the facts rather than sort of come down and say this is the right thing and the wrong thing. But it's very, very interesting speaking to people who've been in the CIA, for example, and other intelligence organizations who've taken part in the past in some methods that have involved torture or handed people over to do this kind of torture. What they say is, number one, it very rarely works. You very rarely get good information. Sure, you get people to confess, but the good information is not what you get. And most importantly, you know, it's like a poisoned fruit. It's very, very tempting in the short term, but it can lose you wars. And you can't keep these things secret forever. People are going to find out. It'll divide your society. People are going to be put on trial. And the world will turn against you. That's the sort of thing that people who actually, you know, are in this business say. And there's a lot of internal dispute about these kind of things. And, you know, when the vice president this week spoke on the phone to Dakota, saying that he agreed it was a no-brainer to dunk a prisoner underwater to save lives. Well, he may have been speaking for a lot of people saying that, but, you know, that's torture. It's a threat to kill. It's under the law. It's torture. And sometimes I think some people are on a different wavelength. And it was very interesting speaking to someone who was in the CIA who described exactly that scenario. And he said, you know, try putting the president underwater like that. You know, his hand that would be up in a second saying this is torture. Of course it's torture. You know, let's be honest about it.
Yeah, Yeah. Stephen Gray, ghostplane.net, the website. Ghostplane, his new book, the true story of the CIA's torture flights, torture program. Stephen, I believe the Secretary of State or the Secretary of Defense, a member of the administration, was in The Hague yesterday.
Right.
And you can correct me and let me know who it was. I'm sorry I'm mixing them up. But basically made a statement to the effect of we need to reconfigure or reconsider the Geneva Conventions. And the Minister of Defense of the Netherlands, which is, you know, generally considered one of the more progressive and pro-liberty, anti-torture. I mean, you know, the International Court is in The Hague, where Slobodan Milosevic was tried, for example, said, we need to reconsider the Geneva Conventions. I don't know if the person from The Hague, from the Netherlands, was saying we need to make them more rigorous, whereas the American was saying we need to make them more lax, or if they were both saying we need to make them more lax. But I'm curious, in researching this book, Ghostplane, as you were talking to, and I'm assuming you did, talking to people around the world and in other countries who may be in policymaking positions, is there a concern that by the United States violating the international norms? I mean, we have now done things that we tried people for at Nuremberg. We
Right.
tried people at Nuremberg for waterboarding. That was one of the crimes that some of the people were charged with. Now that we have done things that people were tried for at Nuremberg, we've established a new standard, a new lower standard of what is called civilization around the world. And is there a possibility, number one, that we are actually changing the nature of what we call civil society? And is there a concern about that? And number two, is there a possibility that down the road we could see members of this administration in the same dock that Slobodan Milosevic was?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the first point about it's what you've seen with the Geneva Conventions is there are some pretty clear rules in there. And what you've had is one lawyer after the other in the administration has come forward with new sort of legal technicalities to try and pretend that somehow the Geneva Conventions don't apply. Well, they're very broad, and they essentially say throughout them, you know, whatever situation you're in, it's an international conflict, domestic conflict, you've got to treat people correctly. You can't treat people cruelly. You can't torture. You can't use coercive interrogation. And they've been trying to find ways around it. Maybe the Geneva Convention, some people in Europe say, need to be rewritten, but they need to be rewritten just to spell out what every time they've revised these laws they've been trying to do, which is that, you know, that always applies. You can't get around them. They aren't designed to say, oh, well, you know, let's relax these things from one time to the other.
Might we see members of the Bush administration subject to international prosecution?
Well, there's certainly some war crimes being committed. And
in your opinion, or the opinion of whom?
It's the opinion of major lawyers and also people within the governments, some European governments, that the use of torture in a very systematic way could lead to charges of war crimes. Let me give you an example. What the defense actually likes to call it the work of the night shift at Abu Ghraib, acts that were not authorized from above.
Mm-hmm.
What you see in the CIA program, which was much more limited and much more controlled, but also in a way more chilling, because when you take an act like waterboarding, which, as you say, people have been tried for before, this wasn't a kind of rogue act carried out by people acting on their own. This was approved all the way to the top. That's a significant thing.
Being that you're talking about the extraordinary renditions.
I'm talking about the
waterboarding. The use of torture.
Where the CIA had its own prisoners, and they had measures, an interrogation program, what George Bush called an enhanced interrogation method.
Right.
Which included this use of waterboarding.
Amazing.
And
Stephen Gray.
All
the way to the top. Stephen Gray, the book is Ghostplane. The website, ghostplane.net. Stephen, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
16 minutes past the hour.
I'm just an old truth teller. I'm your candid friend. I'm not some daydream seller. I do not pretend. I've a sense of survival and screwing my rivals that's labeled me crass and uncool. But I can't help it, I just tell the truth.
And welcome back to the True People's Radio, the free speech zone, no RNC pass required. No, you're not going to be herded over into the corner inside the barbed wire fence. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with us, with you. Diane Benson is on the line. This is our Taking Back America segment for the day, although we don't have the Take Back America bumper music here for it. We'll just pretend we did. Diane Benson, her website, bensonforcongress.com. She's running for Congress in Alaska against Don Young. Diane, I believe that Alaska is like my old home of Vermont. It has one member of Congress?
That's correct.
So you are running as a Democrat against Don Young, the Republican who is currently representing Alaska. And what are the, in your mind, what are the major and significant differences between you and Don Young?
Well, I'm willing to work with other members of Congress in a respectful manner. And I think Don's reputation has given Alaska pretty much a black eye for a number of years. He is a 34-year incumbent. He pretty much rubber stamps the Bush agenda. That makes us completely different because I really want to see maximum benefit for all Alaskans, something I say to the state. And also, my campaign is a people's campaign, and this has been made very clear by the response because this is a campaign that has happened totally on a grassroots level. We have not had the support of the national at this point, and as a matter of fact, this, I think what exemplifies this campaign the best is when I get on a plane and I meet teachers and fishermen and people going places, they're talking to me and telling me they're supporting me. Go into a restaurant and waitresses come up and tell me, we're praying for you, we're pulling for you. When I hear that kind of thing from the valets at the hotel when I'm going into a place to speak and from the doorman running up to say, you know, are you Ms. Benson? We are voting for you. And that makes it very clear to me. This is about people. People have felt like they have not been represented in this state. And I know people have really tried to accept and believe the seniority argument that Don Young brings out each and every election as to why people should vote for him. I don't know that it's going to fly this time.
Yeah. Just saying, I've been around a long time, therefore I should be around longer. Just and hey, I've accumulated a little bit of power. Well, yeah, you've accumulated a little bit of corruption, too, I would say, to Don Young. We're talking with Diane Benson. Benson for Congress, forcongress.com is her website. Diane, one of the themes, and we only have a couple minutes left before I have to take a break here. One of the themes of your campaign is prosperity, not poverty. You say poverty is not freedom. That's, that echoes, in my mind, Franklin Roosevelt, where he, in his 1936 address accepting his party's nomination to run for a second term, he said, a necessitous man is not a free man. In other words, if you can't pay for food or heat or the medication you need, you're not free, no matter what the cons say.
Exactly.
So tell me how this, in your mind, how does this translate into policy?
Oh, my. Well, I feel like we're, my urge is to go philosophical, and I'm trying to avoid that.
Well, you know, Franklin Roosevelt translated it into things like Social Security, minimum wage, strengthening
livable
unions.
Correct. Livable wage is a discussion I want the nation to have to the point that I want to see Congress freeze its own wages until they can address this issue for America. I also don't want to see us continuing into the black hole over a war rather than resolving it. Don Young denies global warming. I know it exists. It has a profound effect on Alaska. Our communities need energy independence, and renewable energy development is one pathway, I think, to freedom. And I think this administration, through people like Don Young, have avoided and hindered the freedoms of Americans. We are only 9 points separating each
you and
other
Don,
right now.
You and Don
points.
Young in this campaign?
Yes.
That's great. So not only our listeners on KUDO in Anchorage, Alaska, who are listening to us live right now, but as well our listeners all around the country. If you're looking for a race where you may be able to make a difference helping out, Benson, B-E-N-S-O-N, forcongress.com is the website for Diane Benson. And this is a major House seat because it represents the entire state of Alaska.
Yes, it does. And it's a huge geographical place, but we only have the road mileage of Rhode Island. And we rely heavily on marine and aviation here. And a person has to live here to really keep that in mind. Don says he's here 85 days out of the year. And even if that's true, that's not very much time.
Yeah, you say on your campaign website, wages that keep the average American from being able to afford a home even with two incomes is not liberty. No American should have to choose between heat or food. Is that a problem for Alaskans?
You bet it is. As a matter of fact, one of our villages recently just ran out of fuel, and they're still trying to get fuel to the village.
And winter hasn't started, or it's just beginning. What?
Yeah, winter's begun.
Yeah, I guess in parts of Alaska it has begun, probably in full force. Okay.
We have snow.
There you go. Diane Benson, the website bensonforcongress.com. Spelled just the way it sounds, B-E-N-S-O-N, Benson for Congress. Good luck, Diane.
Thank you.
Thank you for being with us today. Much appreciated. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting for a Change. And welcome back to the place where smart people get their news. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Amazing. What's in the news today, just looking at the front page of the paper, foreclosures, orgy of spending on political ads, 700 miles of border fence. Yeah, like that's going to solve the problem, right? Beijing, this is a good one. This is the New York Times. Beijing leaders are targets of inquiry. Corruption probe focused on those seen as resisting Chinese president's policies. Now, here's the bottom line. What's happening in China right now? President Hu Jintao is starting to crack down. Here we have a communist dictatorship. He's purging his upper ranks of the party, using corruption as the excuse. A widening Chinese anti-corruption investigation, writes Joseph Kahn in the New York Times, is taking aim at Beijing's party leaders, a sign that President Hu Jintao intends to continue removing officials he considers insufficiently loyal, people told some about the leadership's planning said. The purge is on. These are the good buddies of the Bush administration and the Walton family. Amazing. On it goes. Lee in Seattle, Washington. 1-866-440-8466, by the way, our telephone number. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. Lee in Seattle. Hey, Lee, what's up in your mind today?
Hi, good morning.
What's on your mind?
Thank
today?
You. I really thank you for the information and service you rendered to we the public. I have a couple of conservative friends who recently reiterated the big lie that has been bandied about that the press is liberal in this country, and having worked for years in broadcasting, I completely believe anything that it's anything but a liberal press. I was wondering if you can give me a place where I can gain actual documentation of really where the press and media lie in their political leanings.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. If you go to Media Matters for America, there's an article, for example, Third Time's Not the Charm, Sunday morning talk show is still imbalanced. And they looked at, you know, who's on Meet the Press this week with George Stephanopoulos and Face the Nation. And, for example, looking just from the period from January to March of 2006, so right now, Republicans 44% of the time on Meet the Press, Democrats 27% of the time, and people who are supposedly neutral, you know, like editor of the Wall Street Journal kind of thing, 29% of the time. So, you know, Republicans outnumber Democrats about 2-1. That's on Meet the Press. On This Week with George Stephanopoulos, Republicans to Democrats 46% to 32%. A little less than 2-1, but still significant. Face the Nation, 47% Republicans, 32% Democrats. I mean, you know, if it's Sunday, it's conservative, right? I mean, that's just, you know, right across the board. And MediaMatters.org has really done probably one of the best jobs on this. Another good source of information is Fair.org, the Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And they, you know, they point out, they just lay it out. We have a very, very conservative media in the United States. And it doesn't represent even, you know, like conservative interests of average Americans. It represents the interests of corporate America and of inherited wealth. I mean, that's really what it's boiling down to, tragically, in the United States.
And wouldn't you say that it has been that way for many decades now, since particularly the 70s?
Yeah, I'd say since the 80s, actually. It was in 1987, Ronald Reagan fundamentally changed the rules of broadcasting. And prior to that, radio stations and television stations, in order to maintain their licenses, had to, because of the fairness doctrine and whatnot, and not just, you know, provide both sides of the story, but they had to perform what was called public service, community service. And in other words, we're using your airwaves in exchange for the people's airwaves, access to the people's airwaves. We're going to make sure that one of the fundamental, essential pieces of democracy in America, that is free availability of and broad availability of information, the news, a well-educated populace, to quote Thomas Jefferson, or a well-informed populace, rather, that was a reality. And so the networks and local radio and television stations had news operations that were comprehensive and thorough and actually provided news rather than infotainment. I would submit to you, Lee, that right now 75% of the information on any given newscast is not news. It's infotainment. And only a small sliver out of it is actually news. Well, it used to be that you had to present the news, because if you didn't present the news, your station would lose its license. And so the networks lost money on their news operations. Local stations lost money on their news operations. I know I worked in the business back then. In the 1970s, I did news for a radio station in Lansing, Michigan for about 7 years. And we had a bunch of people working in that news. My recollection is there were five of us working in the news department of one radio station in a small market. You know, Lansing, Michigan. This is not a huge media market. And that was the cost of keeping the license. Well, nowadays, the radio stations don't have to do that. They're getting rid of their news department. You've got 2.5 minutes of news at the top of the hour, and that's about it. And it's much more profitable. But the question is it serving the public interest? And frankly, I think it's not. And, you know, tragically, so. Go ahead.
If I may, I'd like to also ask you about this issue of the Internet that the powers that be are looking to work at making it, at basically taxing the Internet. And I'm wondering, is there anything, what can we do as consumers to ensure that this is kept on a free and fair and open basis?
Yeah, well, there's two issues. The one with regard to tax typically has to do with whether or not sales over the Internet should be subject to state or local sales taxes. And up until this point, federal legislation has prevented that from happening in most locales, by and large. And so the Internet has, sales on the Internet have a certain advantage over other sales. You know, I could argue the benefits or the problems of that, frankly. The larger issue is access to the web. And that's not access from people like you and me, you know, how we dial into it. We're already paying for that. And we pay based on our usage, generally speaking. You know, high-speed access is more expensive than dial-up, for example. But rather,
right,
what they want to say is that they're going to create a two-tiered Internet. And they're going to say that if you want to create a website and it starts getting popular, that you have to pay a whole lot more to have access to the web. So it's basically a pay-for-play operation. And so the progressive websites that get a lot of hits, or for that matter, conservative website, any kind of website that gets a lot of hits, that gets a lot of activity, is going to have to pay more to the small number of corporations that are rapidly consolidating control over the Internet. And you can build an economic case for that, but it is an anti-democratic economic case, because what we may well end up with is that basically, if you want to have a website of any consequence at all, you're going to have to pay, you know, $10,000, $20,000, $50,000, $100,000 a year, maybe $1 million a year, maybe $5 million a year. Just like right now, if you want to get onto cable TV, you have to pay, you know, I think right now it's going around $5 a subscriber to get in. I believe that's what Fox got in at when they started the business. In fact, I think they were paying as much as $10 a subscriber, paying to the cable systems to be carried on cable systems. Now, you know, sometimes the model flips around and the cable systems pay the providers as they become more popular. But that's how you get in if you want to get on cable, is you pay the cable providers. And so the internet guys are saying, you know, we want to do the same thing. And what that's going to mean is the Disneyfication of the internet. You're going to have a half a dozen corporations that can afford to pay, or maybe a few hundred corporations that can afford to pay the big bucks to have major websites and to subsidize minor websites the same way that the Joe Coors before he died and Richard Mellon Scaife and the Bradley Foundation and some of these very wealthy right-wing foundations, the Walton family who helped fund the Swift Boat Veterans, Robert Perry, the Texas developer who openly and largely funded the Swift Boat Veterans. These guys with big bucks will be able to run the big websites, and everybody else will be standing out in the cold. And that's where right now there is a law that says you can't do that. You have to have neutrality on the Internet. Everybody has equal access to provide information on the Internet, to put up a website. And you can't be charged differently based on what your website is, based on the size of the website, based on the content of the website, or any other arbitrary criteria. You can, you know, if you don't buy enough, you know, if you buy a dial-up line instead of a T1 line, you know, people may find that your website loads slower, but that's the market at work. But what these guys want to do is they want to be able to say, we're going to be able to charge anybody anything we damn well please and thus have control over the content of the Internet. And you have Senator Gordon Smith, for example, on that side, the Republican from Oregon, and you have Ron Wyden, the Democrat from Oregon, on the other side. And I'm using them as an example because I think it's a classic one. Ron Wyden is actually filibustering this. He put a hold on the legislation, and Gordon Smith is out there trying to bust that filibuster and turn the Internet over to, you know, basically Verizon and AT&T and, you know, a half a dozen other companies that around the country are the large providers of Internet services. And it's wrong, and it's anti-democratic. We need to have democratic media.
What can we do
contact your member of Congress and both your senators and tell them that you support net neutrality and you intend to hold them accountable if they don't. It's that simple. Everybody knows what this means. You support net neutrality and you will work aggressively to defeat them in the next election if they don't support net neutrality, because this is going to come up, particularly if the Republicans hold the House and the Senate. This will come up very, very quickly in the next session, because they realize, these guys, these cons, they realize that the Internet has become a major force for organizing progressives in the United States, and they want to destroy that. They really don't want us to have access to BuzzFlash.com and CommonDreams.org and HuffingtonPost.com and CrooksAndLiars.com and RawStory.com and all these websites. They really don't want us to have access to it. Or if we do, they want to make sure that those people are beholden to big money interests, because that's what they're all about, is big money interests. Thanks a lot for the call. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more right after this.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, special thanks to my producer David Poole, to Louise Harbin, to Alex Goldmark, Clay Kaplis, Andrew Dunn, Lauren Kirshner at Air America Radio, mixing and putting together this program, getting it up on the satellite and out to our affiliates, to Ben and Shelby over at the White Rose Society, radiopower.org, to Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, particularly Sacred Grounds Coffee and Small Dog Electronics and the Organic Wine Company, and to you for listening. Thank you. Thank you all. And just a quick heads up, this weekend, tomorrow, Saturday, I will be in Tacoma, Washington at 1 o'clock at King's Books, signing books. KingsBookstore.com is their website. Signing Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class. I'm going to be giving about a one-hour rant there about that. And then at 3 o'clock, I'll be at a fundraiser for the local Democratic Party in Tacoma. And for that, contact the Tacoma Democratic Party. It'll be at 3902 North Proctor Street. It'll be at 3 o'clock. And I don't have a website for that. I'm sorry. So, anyhow, that's what's happening. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Don in Carbondale, Illinois, listening in WINI. Hey, Don, what's up?
Oh, good afternoon, Tom. didn't get a chance to speak with the congressman this earlier today. Spoke with him about 2 years ago, and my question to him at that time and to you now, has there been any movement in requiring everybody to pay into the Social Security system, including teachers and university employees and so forth? That is one of the ways that we can make up the deficit, you know, of what we've got. I know there's other ways, but I write my senators, they write back just generic letters and don't really want to touch the issue. What do you have to say about it?
There are, you're right, there are a few exceptions where people, it's not, certainly not all teachers and not all government employees, and members of Congress do pay into Social Security and they're eligible for Social Security.
Yeah.
But there are some exceptions. Those exceptions are few and far between. I don't think that they should be there, frankly. I agree with you. I don't know of any legislation that's been put forward to change that.
Do you wonder why people that you would think, especially like Sandra Obama or Sandra Durbin, why they don't want to touch the issue?
I think probably because it's not a big issue. I mean, the amount of money that we're talking about is not going to change the status of Social Security.
It would help, but the point, what I'm trying to say is, you said last Thursday, speaking with a lady, when you refer to it as an insurance program, then everybody should pay into it.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, as I said, I'm agreeing with you, Don. I'm agreeing with you in criticizing members of Congress for not fixing that. Although, I think that removing the cap on Social Security so that the system will be funded forever is probably far more important. And my guess is that, you know, people are not fighting these small battles because there's some big battles that need to be fought. But I frankly don't know, and I'm not enough of an expert on Social Security to give you the details of, you know, what the percentage or, you know, how much those folks who are exempt from Social Security represent.
4% of the working force, and that came from the Social Security.
It's 4% of the workforce, yeah.
Yes.
So, yeah, that's 4% is not going to come even close to solving what will be a problem for Social Security about 35 years from now, what, you know, is not a problem at all right now. But I agree with you, something should be done about it. Thanks for the call, Don. I got to move along. Rick in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, listening on KOPT. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Hi, I have my ballot right in front of me and the pen ready to mark my last slot. It happens to be state ballot measure 39.
Right.
I have to tell you, I understand emotion on both sides of this. I'm just wondering what your take on this whole thing is.
Yeah, I don't mind talking about it, even though it's an Oregon story, because it is being played out all across the United States.
Right.
Measure 39, for those folks who are outside of Oregon, is a response to the Kelo decision of the Supreme Court, which said that municipalities, counties, and state governments, and the federal government for that matter, can take private land from private property owners and give it to other private property owners if it's going to solve problems, if it's going to help the community. And in fact, that has been being done in the United States for the better part of 60 or 70 years. We used to call it urban renewal. And it was done to fight blight. And that's why the Supreme Court in the Kelo decision said, yes, you can continue doing this. Because if they'd said no, then huge swaths of America where slums had been turned into more decent housing would have to be undone. I mean, it would turn everything on its head. The bottom line is that I agree with the folks over at Willamette Week. Number one, that this is a problem, a solution in search of a problem. The fact of the matter is that very rarely, I think the case in Connecticut was one of those ones where it shouldn't have happened, but very rarely do governments use the power of eminent domain in ways that are inappropriate, and particularly in a state like Oregon where you have a very active populace, politically active and engaged, it's just extremely unlikely it's going to happen, number one. So I voted no on Measure 39 just because I didn't think it's that big an issue. And number two, I voted no on Measure 39 because these anti-Kelo arguments, now the old Bill Moyers show did a great expose on this, where are being used in the case of Oregon. There's a particular guy here who basically makes a living getting money from right-wing cranks, out-of-state right-wing organizations, and putting right-wing ballot measures on. And they'll have like three or four that they're doing. And they'll put the anti-Kelo one on the top of the page and say, hey, do you want to stop the government from taking your private property? And people say, oh, yeah, sure, no matter what their political. And then they say, oh, by the way, while you're signing that, will you sign the – sometimes they do it phony. I don't think they did in Oregon. But sometimes they'll say, I don't have carbon paper. I need you to sign the second one. And what you're signing is one to make abortion illegal. Or will you sign the third one? And it's some other right-wing thing, you know, to strangle government. And so I just don't want to – I don't want to be supporting – you know, that guy and that agenda. So I voted no on 39.
Frank, I appreciate it.
Yeah, you're welcome, Rick. And not that I'm saying that you should or you shouldn't. I mean, you know, I'm not making voter recommendations this year, but I will tell you how I voted. So, in fact, in Oregon, I voted yes on 44, and I voted yes on 46 and 47, and that was it, just for our listeners on KOPT and KPOJ. It's 57 minutes past the hour. Well, we're wrapping up the day. We're wrapping up the week. We'll see you on Monday. Have a great weekend. And remember, democracy begins with you. Get out there and get active. Tag your it.
Our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.